You're listening to L&D in Action, winning strategies from learning leaders. This podcast, presented by Get Abstract, brings together the brightest minds in learning and development to discuss the best strategies for fostering employee engagement, maximizing potential, and building a culture of learning in your organization. This week, my guest is Ross Stevenson. Ross is Chief Learning Strategist at Steal These Thoughts, a brand he founded to help L&D pros improve their performance with technology. Having previously worked at Tesco, Trainline, and Filtered, Ross has a breadth of experience as a learning technologist and developer with industry-leading organizations. I discovered Ross through his AI for L&D Crash Course after I Googled the words AI for L&D Crash Course. It was immediately clear Ross had marketing chops given the SEO victory. More importantly, though, he is among the few L&D thought leaders who have dedicated significant time and energy to teaching practical steps for working with AI. I was eager to bring Ross on to help cut through the speculation and conjecture around AI in favor of some actionable insights. Let's dive in. Hello, and welcome to L&D in Action. I'm your host, Tyler Lay, and today I'm speaking with Ross Stevenson. Ross, thanks for joining me today. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
My first question to you, very simply, you write a lot about AI in the learning world, specifically generative AI. People have been dabbling with ChatGPT for a while now, Copilot, various other resources. It seems like you've tested out a lot of them yourself. Mm-hmm. I am curious what you think the greatest value add for Gen AI is right now, specifically for learning professionals and learning leaders. Is it what power it has for the individual to optimize one's own work? Mm-hmm. Is it something systematic, something that can be applied organizationally right now? What is the greatest value add that you can describe or that you have seen so far for Gen AI in the learning world?
Yeah, so it's probably a bit of both of those. So I think from the L&D professional and L&D leader standpoint, evidently there is that first, as most industries, with how can I optimize this stuff? How can I do it at speed, maybe higher quality? So, you know, that's definitely kind of one part of it. And a lot of my conversations with companies usually start off in saying, how do we optimize what we're doing? How do we streamline what we're doing? We don't want to end up doing, you know, an extra 20 hours of admin a month. I've heard this ChatGPT thing can do that. So can it, and how can we do that? So I think in the L&D Pro side, there is the optimization of the workload. There's still understanding that digital technology, as in how is it going to reshape the career of people in that industry. And that's also kind of a good point to touch upon. I think for the end user, or what people would call learners in most fields, is for them, what I see with a lot of kind of case studies at the moment, and even being at companies where they're doing a lot of these tests, is like, one is that personalized learning. So everyone's always spoken about the industry, you know, definitely the last decade, about personalizing learning. No one's actually got the solution to that. That's usually ended up being, oh, we'll put their name in an email or their name on a course. You know, that's kind of the level of personalized learning, or using recommendation systems in many of the LXPs and NMSs. Whereas we look at assistants like ChatGPT, like Copilot, like Perplexity, large language models for the first time can actually give that personalization to say, well, this is the role I do. This is the age bracket I sit in. This is the industry that I sit in. These are the specifics that I need to know at my stage of the career. I think that's a really, not a beautiful thing, but incredibly valuable thing in order to do that. And with the current technology that we have had, we've not been able to crack that at all. No one's been able to say, how can we personalize it to that level? So that is one. And like the second bit is, and obviously Josh Burson kind of coined this back in 2018, is learning in the flow of work. Mm-hmm. And my kind of observation is, I don't think he meant learning in the flow of work as in people, everyone leaves their screen to go to an LMS or LXP and then move from different software applications to find the information. I think he generally meant, if I could stay on one screen and get all the information I needed, or if I could be in one place and learn the things that I need, that'd be great. And if we look at large language models, like particularly Copilot, that sits in a lot of people's browsers, for me, that really is that kind of learning in the flow of work. And I've seen it in organizations where they've been using Copilot, and they'll sit there, and it's not necessarily a training session. They might be in a meeting. They might be talking about some complex topics, and people are using Copilot in that meeting to say, okay, so we're looking at this framework. You know, what are three kind of key things that I need to understand about this framework? And they're learning kind of in that moment where it's happening. Now, the industry doesn't really kind of coin that as quote unquote learning, but it really is people saying, oh, okay, I'm able to move my kind of performance gap here, and saying, I didn't know about this thing And now I do know about this thing, and I know a bit more about that. And if I want to go and delve deeper, I can potentially do that with a human if I want to. So yeah, but in sum, look, L&D people, it's definitely on optimization, using new technology to maximize what we're already doing from human capability. And then for the user, and these are just the kind of use cases we're looking at now, is 100% personalized learning, you know, really getting that learning in the flow of work and then building the infrastructure on there, because we're, you know, we're still so early in this journey.
My first job was in publishing coming out of college about a decade ago. I worked for one of the major American publishers, and the most important thing that we were doing at the time, I was in sales. I was selling textbooks essentially to university professors and courses. And the most important thing that we were doing at the time was transitioning to digital, going from, you know, hey, here's a big old physical textbook to here is, you know, an ebook version of that, but also here are additional resources to just help your learning, you know, pedagogically sort of change things up. And adaptive and personalized learning were huge at the time. Every competitor of ours and my company at the time was trying to create the best, awesomest, coolest, adaptive, personalized learning tool. And I remember very specifically, most of them took information exclusively from that company's, you know, existing content base, if you will. So, you know, from the textbooks that they had made for themselves, and they kind of, you know, just took the resources and planted them on top of those textbooks. And a lot of the professors that I spoke to weren't so interested in that sort of thing. They were also just kind of disinterested in the competitive nature of publishing at the time. And they were becoming more interested in these sort of like open source resources and utilizing things that were, you know, free to their students, but also just took information more broadly instead of from a specific set of experts, that sort of thing. And what this has me thinking about is, you've written about these things as well, is that a lot of really high level sort of AI implementations seem to come from, you know, organizations that have a really strong capacity for content. McKinsey and Lilly, for instance, which you've written about. I remember reading about their creation of Lilly, you know, probably a year ago at this point, where, you know, they essentially took their existing precedent, their sort of giant library of cases and research that they had done from, you know, past work, and they turned that into sort of an LLM, and they made from that a tool that they could refer to. And I'm just curious what this says about most organizations, because it feels like those who have really strong existing content bases can always do that next thing in technology, where you can sort of take, you know, the adaptive, personalized, or just, you know, the really strong sort of data-based play, because you have all this information, you can sort of put a new product, a new tech product on top of that, and then roll that out as something new, or just use it for your own internal optimization. My question here is, just with all this in mind, what can your average organization learn from the fact that somebody like McKinsey, or I can't remember the other one that you wrote about as well, maybe one of the banks, I think. But what can you know, a regular old organization that doesn't have this sort of record keeping history or precedent, what can we learn from the processes behind what they did there? Or, you know, what can we actually learn from exactly what they achieved, and then how can we pursue perhaps the same thing with maybe more limited resources, more limited money? Is there anything we can take away?
Yeah, I think the first thing to call out would be, you probably, people listening to this probably haven't got the $1 billion budgets that are sitting behind some of those big companies. But I think the first thing is data, right? And I think you've kind of quite rightly pointed it out, is that these large language models only work well with good data in. If you put shit data in, you're going to get shit outputs. That's pretty much the end of it. And I think that's where we see a lot of things not going well at the moment, is people don't really understand. And it's not really for the L&D world too, but at least partnering with technology people in the business to understand that, what is that content architecture that sits under it? So businesses have two options really when it comes to the data bit. It's either, do we just buy a very standard pro license to these tools and allow people to kind of, to an extent, not run wild, but give them guardrails in terms of what can you input in company data. Now, I think that is probably more advantageous to a lot of people in startups and scale-ups, where they're kind of more happy to kind of put in some data that's, maybe some of it's confidential, maybe some of it's non-confidential, and then to use the sources that ChatGPT, Claude, and Perplexity already have to do that. The other option for these people is to then say, well, you know what, if we've got the money, and we're in an organization like 10,000 people plus, we'll go to an enterprise level. We'll get to an enterprise tool. And fundamentally what that means is, you know, you could go to OpenAI today and say, either I want to select the ChatGPT Teams model, where basically it's a blank slate, you get the technology, and then you have to provide the training database for that version of their model, and the same for the enterprise level as well. And then what you have there is basically, so in the machine learning world, they call it fine-tuning, where basically you fine-tune your company's data to that. So it may be an example, if in some strange world, an L&D team decided we're going to get a small large language model to help us with skills identification and skills development in the organization, you could buy one of those kind of off the shelf without any of their own database, have your own skills database, and plug it into that to do that. Now, a lot of people are not going to do that. And there are very few people even doing it at the moment in time, because some of it is slightly complicated. And there's other risks in there in terms of, you know, who owns data, where does the data go back to, how is it being housed on different servers and whatever countries in that. So there's huge kind of implications that happens with that. So in terms of the learning, it's definitely going, look, you need to get your data in order. You need to be really clear on, if you buy this tool, it's not saying, let's just give it all the crap we've already got and just hope it makes sense of it. I mean, it will definitely make sense of that in some ways. So, you know, I made a joke, I think, in an article about someone called Dorothy has got a secret SharePoint somewhere and she's locked up all the kind of key processes for the finance team. It's like, you know, you can connect that into the large language model and it'll be easier to find. But it still doesn't take away from the fact that the actual architecture of your data in the organization is probably not good. And you could probably use a large language model to help you restructure that in that way. So 100%, you know, you want to look at the data element. I think the next element that makes these things successful is that there are people in these organizations who are already advocates of this technology, mm-hmm. and they're already working with, I think the examples that we were talking about as an example, they have been working with OpenAI, which is obviously the big sexy company, which is doing a lot of generative AI tools at the moment. So for some of those companies, it may be wise to partner with someone who are specialists in that field where you can buy technology from them. They can help lead you in that way as well. But advocacy in the organization in terms of really understanding what are the opportunities with, if we're talking about conversational AI in particular, so large language models, and what are the limitations of that as well. And the reason why I say that is because I must admit, every call I've had this year with a client in some way has ended up being in unrealistic expectations of what the technology can do. And I think that needs to be put into check immediately. And we can see in those case studies where, you know, McKinsey were very clear on, we have three specific use cases in, is to give better access for our research to clients and also internally. And it's to allow people internally to use that information in human conversations and be able to do that at speed and quality. What they weren't saying was, oh, we want to bring in this large language model to automate all these things that it can't do, to solve all these mission critical problems at the C-suite level, which is not going to do very well. So having that advocacy, having the real understanding of what is your use case, to finding that problem and making sure that technology can solve that problem is the other main component of that. I mean, the last component of this is going to be how it's introduced into the organization. I mean, L&D can learn a lot from this, as they can learn a lot from the marketing world in terms of how are you actually positioning this in the organization. And the worst thing you can do, and we see this a lot of L&D tools I have over my time, is you just send that one email one day and say, hey, by the way, we bought this thing. We've called it this. Here it is. Here's a quick FAQ on a PDF. Go and figure out how to do that. That's not the approach these organizations took. You know, they brought people on board when they were acquiring the technology. They had people on board to kind of look at what's the data governance. How do we introduce this to the organization? What are some of the ways that we can do that? So it's definitely, the final point would be, do not sleep on how do we actually introduce this and how do we help people understand how to use it? Because I would say that although if you go on social media, it feels like everyone is using generative AI and, you know, they're all optimizing their workflows. They're making millions of dollars and coming to, in the reality, it's not actually that. If you go to most organizations, and I'm still shocked by this, when I say to people, how many of you have used a conversational AI tool? It's nowhere near as many people as I expect. I might be in a room of 200 people, and I would say most of the time, it's only about 20% of people that have even tried it. They might have heard of it, but they've never tried it. So there's that issue of how do you move people from what I've seen in the digital world to how do I actually apply that practically and meaningfully? So in sum, like I said, those would be the core bits that I would pick up from those case studies.
Isn't in the Ross Stevenson canon, I believe Dorothy is also the one with too many cat pictures in her SharePoint.
She is, yeah.
Yeah,
she
okay. is, yeah. I did my research. So I think you make an interesting point there about how to roll it out, because I've worked in marketing for many years now, and just understanding how much it takes to get somebody's attention away from whatever they are doing and focused on something new, even when that thing could help them greatly, is so much more than an email or even a single line of communication. You got to hit them from multiple angles. You got to have champions who are advocating for the thing. You got to have it, you know, fully fleshed out and demonstrated in some cases. And there's just so much to do there. Mm-hmm. I do want to follow up and just ask, you know, we're talking about data and, you know, putting data into these tools. What kinds of things can we put in there? So I'm thinking, like, can we utilize our existing learning content libraries? How effective is that sort of thing? Because in a lot of cases, you know, learning teams are working with outsourced and also internally developed content libraries, which I do think ends up limiting those sorts of things. Are there solutions as to how we can use all that data, all that content? Just like best practices, I assume, if you have like some sort of a Confluence page or whatever with just, you know, all of your company's documentation and that sort of thing. Do you have any specific advice for how to actually, or what to utilize and how to actually, you know, safely and effectively? I know you don't want to talk too much about governance and ethics and all of that, but people have been concerned about, you know, putting your data into these systems and is it going to get stolen? Mm. Is it going to get reused? Whatever. Do you have anything quick to say about just the data that you are putting in?
Yeah, definitely. I think from an organization's perspective, I think the number one rule is just buy an enterprise tool. Don't even chance going with, it's not even open source, but what we call the freemium tools or even the ones where you pay $20, $30 a month. It's not worth it. There's many, you know, Samsung is a really big one over in South Korea where there was an issue there where they allowed people to use ChatGPT and it went absolutely horribly wrong where they started feeding it sensitive financial data, loads of other confidential information. So the main thing you can do in terms of the data element is buy an enterprise tool where it is not sending data back to the supplier. And on the supply note, make sure you're with one of the big suppliers. So, you know, make sure you're with a Microsoft, an OpenAI, an Anthropic, one of the big ones. Don't be going out and seeing Fred on Google says, I've built my own large language model and I'll give it to you for half the price and let you do whatever, because, you know,
find it on Craigslist.
Who knows where that, exactly. Do you know what I mean? Like, who knows where that data is going? So it comes to supplier selection. And of course, you know, the way you can do that as well is that a lot more AI companies now are getting certificates in America and EU in terms of their security standards, which is obviously very favorable to understand on that as well. But from a data standpoint, for any kind of like smart forward thinking company, it's just go for the enterprise tools, because you can't account for human error. And it doesn't really matter how many upskilling programs you do, how many times you tell people, the human is always going to be in the loop. And there's always an error of, you know, poor old Dorothy I'm picking on today, but if she's sitting there and going back and puts in a huge financial report for the year, just thinking, oh, I can do this, it's fine. And it's actually not fine. You don't really have control over that. Whereas if you have an enterprise tool, then you're safe because it's locked down and you can do that. So, you know, in sum, I'd say, look, buy an enterprise tool and pick the right supplier. You know, don't be going out with any old person who has popped up in the last kind of 6 to 12 months, because you go online and everyone's got an AI company. Everyone's got a large language model that they're tailored or whatever. So, you know, go directly to the source. And back to our case studies, the, you know, McKinsey's and all that lot, they were working with OpenAI or they were working with Microsoft. So talk to those companies who know what they're doing. They've, in a Microsoft standpoint, they've got the infrastructure, they've got the history. You know, like I say, it's not going to be someone's mate around the corner who started doing this and wants to kind of bring people on board to do it. So yeah, be safe rather than sorry.
Yeah, you know Don Taylor, my last guest on the show, when he and Egla Vinoskaita did the AI and L&D report, They had three different categories of barriers that they kind of went over, and I don't remember exactly what they were, but looming large, and at least two of them I remember pretty clearly, was like issues of security and governance, and even just internally, it seemed like executive teams had decided against using anything until they felt safer, kind of seemed to be the theme. Like, hey, let's just kind of pause on this until we know for sure that our data will be safe and we're not breaking any rules here. It seemed like there was just a lot of like insecurity and like mindset insecurity about it all. And I think we're clearly moving in the direction of, you know, these are large companies, you know, getting, you know, certified and approved and that sort of thing. So I think over time we'll probably see, you know, more rapid adoption. But
oh, definitely, definitely. I think those companies, to be honest, could do better.
Oh, yeah.
I'll actually say what's on offer. 100%. You know, from a marketing standpoint, you know, I think there's so many companies that I speak to are not even aware of enterprise versions of Copilot or ChatGPT or a Teams version. So it's even that standpoint where maybe some of those fears start to be actually settled if there was more of that and less of, on social media, someone going, here's 25,000 prompts that you need to know or your life is over by tomorrow. I mean, that's, you know, that's how it goes in life. It takes time. I think there's a big curve in terms of moving from what some people might say feels kind of quite gimmicky and quite unsafe right now to actually being more productive and progress. So, but we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Speaking of 25,000 prompts, that's my next question. So on Steal These Thoughts, you talk a lot about prompting and how important that is from an individual user perspective. It is clearly one of the more sort of coveted skills that we can utilize with Gen AI right now. I just want to go over that really quickly. So there are prompt libraries out there from large organizations. You talk about a few of them. You have your own little lessons on prompting. But what do you say about, you know, teaching prompting at the organizational level? If an L&D person wants to go in and make sure that their folks understand how to use these tools most effectively and really optimize their use, what is the best way to help somebody understand prompting for that purpose right now?
Yeah, I think, so there's a couple of things. I think the first thing is you kind of have to unbundle the way people use Google right now, because what people try to do with these tools is behave like they would with Google and just give some keywords. And then, as we both know, what happens is it's the Hunger Games fight for whoever got the best SEO on the day and pushes up the article where those keywords appear. That's not how these tools work. And that's the first thing, because people go to me, oh, this tool's rubbish because I put in, you know, help me find this and it didn't do it. It's completely different things. You've got deterministic system in Google, you've got a probabilistic system in generative AI. So that's hard at the beginning because people have been used to this frame of input and information to digital tools for, you know, 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to help people reframe that a little bit. I think the second bit is to then help people look at, I always say, imagine it like an intern. It's your digital intern. When an intern joins your team, they don't know what they don't know. So you want to provide context, you need to provide specificity. You also need to provide constraints. So to just go off and do loads of kind of crazy random things and try to help stop hallucinations. And what I've also seen in research papers that have come out as an example is that it usually takes about 8 prompt interactions until you can get like a pretty decent quality response. And that makes sense because if you think about if you're conversing with the tool and it's trying to understand you more, trying to understand the task and the context behind that task, then once you kind of get to those 8 prompts, it can do a far better job of helping you versus just, you know, I'm going to give you a couple of sentences. But again, it's all contextual. It all depends on what you're doing and how big the task is. If you're asking one of these large language models to do kind of like multiple steps, then you want to break that down. You want to be really clear on the context and the task. You know, if you're just doing something very simple, like what's the weather today in Portland or something, then obviously that's a different thing. You're not going to go crazy on that. So I would finish off on that. Prompting is definitely important, but you have to also look at it as it is a conversation. And I think what prompting I have found in my own personal use and with teams and doing training is that it encourages people to think more critically and trying to think clearly. And what I mean by that is, and you might understand this also being a marketer and writing as well, is that I think, you know, clear thinking is clear writing and clear writing is clear thinking. And I think the same about that with talking to generative AI tools is that in yourself, you need to be clear on what you're trying to achieve. And when you're inputting that into this tool, it actually challenges you to structure that in a clear way so this tool can understand. I think in some, can't prove this, of course, I think in some quasi way, it kind of helps you probably get better at human communication, because then you think, oh, if I have to give all of that information over to artificial intelligence, what must other humans need when I'm having a conversation with them when they don't know something about the topic and I need them to help me with something? So it's definitely a byproduct of, you know, prompting can definitely lead to hopefully clear thinking, more critical thinking. And I think those bits are needed. You're not going to get good responses unless you spend time on, am I structuring this clearly so it can be understood?
I'm glad you started that segment off talking about unbundling Google a little bit. I have been thinking a lot about other AI skills, if you will, other things that we need to understand about machine learning and how AI has already impacted our lives. And I have learned a lot about how social media platforms work and a little bit about search engines as well in terms of their algorithms and the machine learning behind those tools. And it just seems like it's growing ever more important that we understand at least superficially how all of those things work, how audiences are targeted with content, and how advertising and outside forces influence the things that we use regularly in our daily lives, you know, to understand the world, to learn and to consume content in particular. So I just want to ask you, you know, are there other AI oriented or machine learning oriented skills that you think that we should develop, you know, whether it's Gen AI or if it's just sort of other categories of understanding what it is that we're working with? To me, it's getting a broad understanding of how algorithms work and how they impact, you know, what we consume and what your market consumes, whether you're in marketing or if you're in another, you know, field within your company. What do you think about this sort of like new era of skills? We're talking all about, you know, skills these days in general. So what are those skills that you think are most critical for people to develop going into the future?
Specific machine learning AI, there's a view, and I've got a view on the human side as well that kind of helps enhance those.
Sure.
I agree with what you're saying. I think fundamentals is essential. I mean, if you're using these tools, and it still shocks me because many people don't really understand how Netflix's recommendation system works. Why do you get showed certain posts on TikTok? You know, how do these algorithms keep pushing out stuff? And, you know, inherently in society, it's in your best interest to figure out, why is it I go onto Google and I search for gardening pots and then my YouTube turns up and suggests about 20 gardening pot videos, and then I jump over to Amazon and then I'm starting getting pushed to this? You know, there's all this in the background of this structure, and it's really no different with generative AI, where, you know, people still get confused. They say AI, but generally what they mean is generative AI or a large language model, but they'll keep using the word AI. But obviously artificial intelligence is the main umbrella, which was coined back in 1956 over in the Dartmouth conference. And there are many different subsets that sit underneath artificial intelligence. Obviously, as you know, machine learning being one of them, generative AI being part of the machine learning family. Now, I'm not saying people need to be machine learning experts, but just knowing that and then understanding the model of, as we spoke about earlier, Google being a deterministic system, which basically means if you go into Google and say, I want to fly from London to New York, I want to do it this time on this airline, that'll be factual. If you do it 20 times out of 20 times, you'll get the same response. If you're to do that with a generative AI tool, it doesn't kind of work that way, because it's a probabilistic engine. A probabilistic system, which means it's a probability engine. So there's a great talk, and I'll send you a link afterwards, from one of the heads of AI product at Spotify, where he breaks this down in terms of looking at people make this more complicated than it actually is. And what these large language models do is they try to guess the next word, because they've got all the world's data, and they're going into that data and they're saying, well, if I say how, the next word might be are, and then the next word might be you. What it's trying to do is kind of look at what would be the preferred response based on the input, not always the factual response. So that's why you have these hallucinations. Now, that in itself, when I explain that to people, they then start to kind of turn and go, oh, okay, so that's why I get wrong answers. It's not because there's some kind of dark force at work where it doesn't want to give me the right information and it's kind of making it up for that. If you can help people understand these are the reasons why these things happen, much like we have a common understanding in SEO best practices and, you know, cookies that track you and all of this different stuff, and we know why these things happen because we have that common understanding. We need to have that same common understanding with generative AI in, let's spend half hour on the fundamentals of generative AI, why it does these things, why you as a human need to then use skills like analytical judgment on any of the outputs to say, is this correct? I'll go and check those references. I'll make sure that they are what the tool actually says it is, instead of the other narrative where people generally go to me, oh, it's rubbish, oh, it doesn't do what I want, because their frame of reference is so different at the moment. Their frame of reference is Google, where their frame of reference should be, well, this is how generative AI works. That will take time. But the first thing I do with any company is we don't talk about prompting. We don't talk about tools. I'm literally just like, what is your understanding of how generative AI tech works today and where that sits in large artificial intelligence? If it is, Ross, I have no idea what you're talking about. The immediate thing is, right, we need to focus on the fundamentals. We're not talking about the rest. So fundamentals, 100%. You don't need to be an expert. You do need to be savvy. Of course, I think more skills will come over time. You know, with this, I think as we get into this era of what you call AI agents at the moment, where more people are taking large language models to the next level, where currently these tools are very good at one task or two tasks, but what people really want to do is have something that can do multitasks. So we could say, as an example, you have an idea, you want to feed it to an AI agent, and then that agent would take that idea, it would expand it, it would turn it into a first draft of a blog post, it would build social media posts, and it would do all that in multi-steps without you having to do anything, and then send it to you for review. That will be something that will definitely come up in the future in people to understand, how do I have more of a builder's mindset? And if I'm trying to optimize my workflows, how do I build the right component for that in that world of that technology? But that's kind of like probably a year or 2 years away from that really coming into the mainstream domain. But I think outside of AI, ML even, I think human skill wise, I can't say enough around, you have to really double down on our best human characteristics of critical thinking, emotional intelligence, analytical judgment, you know, bias detection as well. I think bias detection is going to be a really big thing with these tools. You see already in popular media where we're talking about, you know, upcoming elections in America, people are very worried around deepfakes, around information coming in from large language models. You know, I was talking to a company the other day and we were just having like a discussion around, because voice coding's got so good now that people are starting to use kind of like passwords or keywords with family members to make sure it's their actual family member they're talking to, not some voice clone that someone's created to actually call them.
Yeah.
So there's bits in there in terms of the human side of, we need to really get good at those to get better at using generative AI, because generative AI is beautiful in its opportunities, but it's also given us new problems that we need to teach people in. How do you have the right skills to navigate some of those things like, you know, deepfakes or voice cloning, things that we all thought were kind of sci-fi maybe 6-7 years ago, but now really are our reality, and we're going to have to deal with, like, is that a real picture? Is that a real person? Who wrote that? Where is the sources? So it's a different layer of human skills for sure. But again, I think if you connect the fundamentals of how does generative AI work to that, I think that picture becomes a lot easier to understand. Because if you haven't got the fundamentals, you're not going to understand why there's bias, why are there deep fakes, why is there all of this stuff that I need to watch out. So I, at this moment, those are the things that I would definitely encourage people to invest in, no doubt. I wouldn't even look at tools or optimizing workflows if you don't get the basics.
I fully agree with getting this sort of baseline understanding, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of organizations are sort of skipping that. The LinkedIn Workplace Learning Report came out in the last month or two, I think, and they break it down in several ways, kind of where we are. AI is at the center of it all, it seems. I think it's even in like the title of the report, they're talking about AI, and they're saying that L&D is now sort of at the center of organizations thanks to AI, and because it gives us the opportunity to educate our folks on what's happening. Mm. I think Don Taylor and I are a little bit skeptical as to sort of how serious that claim is to be taken. Mm. But at the end of the day, they give a few different ways of viewing sort of how we are, you know, using AI, learning about it, and generally upskilling ourselves for, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, for the future of technology and for AI. They observe three different stages that organizations can be in for an upskilling or reskilling process. The third stage, the final stage, as they put it, is the measurement stage. The middle stage of actually sort of doing is called the activation stage. And I think before that is just kind of like research. And 95% of companies are in those first two stages. About half are in the activation stage of reskilling and upskilling, which sounds like great news, but only 4% and 5% in the year 2022 and 2023, 4% and 5% of organizations were in that measurement stage. And it seems like this is a way that LinkedIn decided to frame, you know, how reskilling and upskilling works. But I do think that's a really critical thing to think about, is once we've determined what skills we're going to change or augment or add to our organizations, how are we measuring the efficacy of that very serious change? Mm. We are looking at a lot of jobs that don't exist right now, probably in the future. We're going to be dealing with jobs that don't currently exist. My jobs that, you know, when I was studying in school pretty much exist in the world. And that wasn't even, you know, with some sort of huge technological innovation. But ultimately, I'm curious if you have any sort of observation about this phenomenon where very, very few companies are in that measurement stage. I'm wondering if it's because we are so desperately trying to predict what skills are actually going to be needed that this like upskilling and reskilling process has a degree of guessing and just kind of like, you know, throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping that something sticks and has efficacy for our organization. And a lot of companies are seeing in that activation stage that the skills we're actually skilling toward, upskilling or reskilling toward, maybe aren't as valuable right now as we initially thought they would be or wanted them to be. And there just isn't enough security around, like, this is what we need to learn that will have value for our organization in the future. So let's do it. Let's assess how it went and then adapt from there. It feels to me like maybe we are just doing a little too much guessing with that reskilling process, and it doesn't really require the measurement process because we're just unsure. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on why so few companies are in that measurement stage?
Look, 100%. I think you hit a nail on the head. To be quite honest, it is like, I use the analogy here in the UK of spraying and praying, where every company I've been at, it is the thing. And that is the big problem in our industry. And it's funny, right? Because I do feel like in some ways that we are very blindsided with the shiny new object in AI right now. And we continue to forget about the classic conundrums we still face. And measurement is such a huge thing in this industry. It has been for the last few decades. And, you know, to your point, it is because, you know, generally leaders just turn up and go, well, I think we need to do these four things this year. I haven't got any data to prove that, but because I'm a leader, we're going to do that. And then L&D team go and execute on that. And unfortunately, that happens too much. Like the amount of people I speak to where they're like, oh yeah, so my leadership team have given me a top-down message to say, we need to do these five skills this year. I'm like, okay, so why aren't they working? What are you doing currently? Like, what's the data from the organization? And unfortunately, generally people go, well, I didn't ask that and I haven't got that data, but we have to do it because they told us to do it. And I get that. There's that friction because you don't want to be like the bull in a china shop. You don't want to be like, depending on your seniority level as well, would go and say, no, Mr. C-suite leader, I'm not going to do that because, you know, we've got this data from our organization. That is one of the problems. I think the second problem is, and to what you just said as well, is that we have grand visions of the skills that we want people to have and we think they should have. Because we don't really have any industry-wide agreed upon data collection method on that, an interrogation method. Everyone's kind of off doing their own things, which may work, which is great, and a lot of them don't work. But what I find a lot of teams don't do is, I've noticed in my career for the last 15 years, is I can't really recall a time I've sat in a room and anyone naturally has actually gone, well, how are we going to measure this? So how do we know this is successful? So if we're going to spend the next 5 years on a human skills transformation project, and we identified these 10 skills. How do we know that's been successful after those 5 years? I think a lot of that is because you generally don't know, because there's so many points, there's so many, you know, hard data points that you can get, but there's a lot of other data points that you can't get as well, in terms of, well, what are people doing with this stuff? How do we show that someone's improved their critical thinking? And I mean, unfortunately, it becomes too much of like a Da Vinci Code style novel problem to solve, where people are like, well, don't really know, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out as we go along. And to your point, no one does figure it out. We kind of just keep going. We do this stuff. And then what happens is we very much fall into the ploy of vanity metrics. And then we'll do this thing of X amount of people had a touch point on this content or this workshop, so they must have learned this thing. They're going to get better. And, you know, then we ask no questions when performance reviews come around and nothing has changed. And then people end up exiting the business, unfortunately, and all those kind of scenarios. So the measurement piece is still huge. And it's good to talk about, because right now AI, is like, it's the same thing I say to people all the time. It's like, if you're going to introduce a large language model to your organization, what is your barometer for success with this?
Yeah.
What is your criteria? What are you looking at to say, at the end of the next year, if you've gone and spent £2.5 million on a large language model integration, how are you going to justify that to stakeholders outside of vanity metrics of 80% of the organization logged on once? I think that's our big issue, is that we don't really know how to assess skills effectively yet. And that's across the board. There is no kind of, there's loads of kind of frameworks out there, but in terms of something that's agreed upon and L&D people aren't fighting about online or behind closed doors, it's really difficult for that. So, I mean, it's not, I haven't got a solution for it. I can tell you now, I've spent many times as a head of L&D cracking my head off the wall trying to get senior leaders to agree on just three metrics of this is what success will look like. So there's a lot playing in there. It's not just the L&D pro that's kind of in control of that. It's also the organization and the constraints that you have in the organization, predominantly with leaders, when you're setting a strategy alongside the business strategy to say, well, okay, this is cool. You know, as an organization, we want to develop growth mindset as an example, but what are the markers around that? And how do we measure that? And what generally happens, like I say, is that that conversation just gets lost as we go on. And then we get to the point, as you were talking about, is you get to the end of a program and then people are like, maybe that was successful, maybe not. And I'll find the article and send it to you as well. It's a couple of years ago from the Financial Times here in the UK. They went to the government here in Whitehall, where all the PMs are, and they basically said, so how much have you spent on training in the last 5 years? And they said to them, we've spent £180 million on training in Whitehall, but we can't tell you on what, and we can't tell you how effective it was. I was reading this article and I was just like, this, as a taxpayer, it's wonderful for me to know that we're paying all this money, but you can't attribute it anywhere. So it's an industry problem. And to, you know, people will listen to this and they might think, well, to be quite honest, maybe we should solve that instead of looking at AI. And I probably say, yeah, you're probably right. Because we're going to fall into the same regime again if people will go, we can build these skills with AI. Amazing. But how are you going to measure that? Like, where is that return on investment? Are you going to be in that situation as well? So there is a lot to unpack there. And I think no one has a golden solution to that. I think there is very much a industry-wide conversation on, and a meaningful conversation on, what does that look like in practice? As we spoke about with AI, a lot of people love to talk about research. Research is great, but what we need is companies that are actually doing this, or they're experimenting with it. And to understand, that was why your question early on was very good around the process with McKinsey, is what was their process? So if something has been successful and they've been able to put a financial metric or performance metric, how did they do that? And then how can we systemize that? So more of that, and probably less of the dubious speculation in conferences where people are like, we need to do more measurement. And it's like, all right, Captain Obvious statement, how do we do it? I don't know, but I want to tell you that. I want to tell you we need to do more measurement. So yeah, that would be my my two cents on it, really.
I McKinsey really is kind of the paradigm of measurement. I believe their slogan is still, what gets measured gets managed. And that's,
yeah,
to me, that's perfect, because it's an acknowledgement that you can't always achieve what you want, but you can manage mm-hmm. everything that you have with the right numbers. And such a large consultancy kind of acknowledging that and having that as their focus, I think is really, really critical to keep in mind, especially now that they've done what they've done with AI. So that's a very important point. We're running up on time here. I want to ask you a couple more questions. So you wrote a very long piece on the structure of a modern L&D team. At the start of the piece, I want to quote you here. Somewhat cryptically, you write, "Perhaps the first question should be if we even call it an L&D team anymore, but I'll leave that debate for another day." Ross Stevenson, the day is today. We're debating now. What did you mean by that exactly? And how can I play devil's advocate on the other end of
it? Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love playing devil's advocate with him. I mean, people get angry when I talk about it. That's the thing. But
I figured.
Maybe you'll understand this more as a marketer, because I am a big believer in the right branding and using that to position your products and your brand correctly in the business.
Yeah.
And I don't think we do that well. I think examples I gave in that article is, if I said the words to you, procurement, finance, sales, you have a pretty good understanding of what they do and their contribution to the organization. But when you say learning and development to people, I kind of find there's this like quasi cult-like guru type thing going on. We're like, I'm not really sure what they do. I know they give me some compliance training that I don't want to do, but I'm not actually sure what they do. What is their contribution? I mean, the problem with that is that it creates a really bad brand. So when you want to do something that is actually going to uniquely position the organization to improve financially and improve from a performance perspective, it's really hard to do that because people just don't know what you do. They don't know your USP. And I mean, if I had my way, I would just literally call teams performance, like learning and performance teams. But people don't want to do that. They want to kind of have it traditional. And I mean, the issue that we have in our industry is that we're very much shackled by the educational model. So people are very familiar with school systems and university and college systems worldwide.
Yeah.
We've then replicated that system in corporate and called it L&D. So it then becomes very hard for people because they associate, you know, difficulties at school or college with exams and having to pass and doing tick boxes with L&D. So for me, there's very much that branding problem. And I think it's about whatever you want to call it. It's just about repositioning that brand. How can you and your organization say, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is how we contribute value, and this is how we do it. I mean, if you can do that and do it well, I think you'll do good things in your organization. But I've yet to come across an L&D team that has done that well enough where all these great things that they are doing that are going to help the business, you know, optimize, make more profit, they're going to help people in their careers because they're going to build skills that they can use at the organization and beyond. They don't get that engagement because the branding it's not right. So for me, it's like, how can you get that branding right? It could be L&D. It could be learning and performance. It could be whatever you want to call it. It could be, I've seen people call them performance institutes. You know, people still call them training departments. The main thing is about how do you get your house in order in terms of your brand and what you do in that company? And you want that very similar to other parts of your organization. If you say sales or marketing, people know. People know what they do. They know what they contribute. They know how that builds the organization. With L&D, they don't. And that's the great shame because, to my point earlier, we spend all this money on programs and we can't measure it. Maybe one of those problems is because people don't actually understand how what the team does contributes to an individual and to the organization as well. So, yeah, my main thing would always be, and people will hate me saying this, but, you know, look at the way, you know, marketing teams and marketers do it. How do they position their brands? How do they build that brand and get people really clear on what their USP is? There's a reason why that stuff works. There's a reason why when we see an Apple advert, we buy from Apple. We know what Apple does. We get super excited because Apple's doing something. Like, it doesn't matter what Apple does. They can release a chair tomorrow and people will get excited. But it's because they built that brand where, you know, it's, you don't have to get to that cult-like level with Apple, but you have to invest in saying, like I say, who you are, what do you do? How do I know as an individual how you contribute to me? If someone says to me, I'm going to work with marketing, so I'm going, okay, these are the people that are going to come in. They're going to help me get really clear on my messaging. They're going to help me get that messaging out so then we can either bring in more revenue, more customers, whatever it is. You say L&D to someone, they're like, what is that person doing? Like, how are they going to help me? Are they going to give me a PowerPoint? They're going to give me some you know, something online somewhere. So I think that is a big thing to look at. Like, I've been banging about that for years, but I think a lot of people see that as a contrarian thought in terms of, you know, a lot of the pushback I get is, why should we do that? We're not marketers. I'm not asking people to be marketers. However, if we have a holistic view in life, I think sales and marketing are a huge part of what we all do as humans. Yes. In any aspect of our work. So I'd encourage people to do it. Whether they listen to me, probably, you know, another question.
Well, you are a marketer and I've read your website front to back. You definitely are using some of these tactics. My last question to you is, what do you do as an educator, as somebody who's also teaching people and convincing people to read and learn from you? What are the things that you do? Do you have a few quick tips for how to get people to engage with your content?
Oh my, yeah. I mean, I'd love to tell you that I have some playbook or some strategy, but I honestly don't. I've just picked up stuff here and there and learned from different people.
You have good headlines, you know, a little bit of scarcity, a little bit of exclusivity here and there, making it accessible in terms of, you know, three tips, five tips, numbers.
Oh God, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's, especially if that, I would say that's increased in the last 2 years, and I could pinpoint to why. So if you want to go and learn from the people who I learned from, I learned from, I read a book called The Art and Business of, I think, Digital Writing from Nicholas Cole.
Okay.
And I also read a book from Anne Hadley called Everyone Writes. I think it's the newest edition. So they seriously up my game in terms of copy, in terms of headlines, in terms of understanding emotion, power words, all of that stuff. You know, outside of the field, SEO game, there's tools that can help you with that. I think online, you know, people like Brian Dean, who I studied from many, many years, probably the last 7-8 years. I picked up a lot from him in terms of SEO. But I think from the actual, I like to think from the conversational standpoint, is the reason why people read my newsletter, and I ask people this because I'm still confused about why thousands of people read it. I think it's generally because I write like I talk. So I don't change my nature. You know, I use a lot of memes. I use a lot of GIFs. You know, my bloody newsletter is called Steal These Thoughts. I haven't called it Ross Stevenson's Learning Academy or some lame name like that. I've tried to purposely put myself on the point of, I am not like what someone gave me the greatest compliment when they said, you don't look like a 9-to-5 guy. I've got long hair, skinny jeans and tattoos. I am most certainly not a 9-to-5 guy. I'm like, thank you. That's a compliment. I take that. But that's what I try to produce in my own kind of like marketing. And what I try to show people, that is just who I am. So I might drop some random Taylor Swift GIF in my newsletter when I'm talking about products and all this kind of stuff. And I think it's the key for me is just, yes, write in your style, but be clear the game you're playing. We're all playing in these kind of games. And you're not like one person that's not really systematically going to shift that system. I am not going to change the world of SEO or the attention economy. But what I can do is understand, how does that world work and how can I apply it to my work in a way that I am comfortable with and that I would write and, you know, make it make sense for me. So like I said, those are the resources that I've learned from. You know, they would give you a lot in terms of crafting headlines, crafting good copy. I mean, the main thing to do is if you go look at an article from me 5 years ago and you go look at an article from me in the last 12 months, I would like to say that, you know, the superiority of now is amazing, but that's continuous learning. I try to practice what I preach is, if I want to get better at these things, I need to go and seek people who are good at these things to understand how do I do that. And that's what I do myself pretty much. And like most people, I'm always a work in progress. So I'm most certainly not the best marketer. I've kind of fallen into this strange world of growth marketing recently with all the stuff that I'm doing. And I love learning more. So I love building copy and landing pages and courses and all this kind of stuff. But I think in some, it's like, much to the AI point, you need to go out and experiment and explore. You need to go and do so. You know, go online, do those things, experiment. You'll come up like I have. You go look at my old stuff. I've had some terrible daft headlines, or, you know, I've made stuff that's too SEO optimized. I've made stuff that's so curveball that I don't think anyone would understand it apart from my own mind. So yeah, it's just learning how to do it. And it will take time. Like, it's not going to be this thing where you might go online to YouTube and someone says, become an overnight marketer and do it. It's not going to happen. It is years and years and years, as you know, of working, learning, doing all this stuff. and growing. So that is the cheesy answer, but that is my honest answer in terms of what you can do.
I appreciate those recommendations, though, the names and the books. But in addition to that, I want to make sure that our listeners do check you out as well. So stealthesethoughts.com, any other places, any other spaces that you want listeners to come and find you, to reach out, to contact you, to view you. You do a lot of these appearances. What else would you like to pitch right now?
Yeah, so the other thing would be, look, I'm on LinkedIn. I play the social game on there. So you might see stuff, you might not, depends how much the algorithm loves me on that day. if you enjoy the kind of thoughts that I'm putting out there, I have a weekly newsletter, which is also called Steal These Thoughts. Of course, that is my attempt at fighting the algorithm. So if you actually want to see my stuff and learn more about all these bits that we've talked about, you know, come and join us there for a conversation. I'd be happy to have you.
Wonderful. Well, Ross, thanks for joining me today. This was a great conversation. Hopefully I can have you back on sometime. For everybody at home, thanks for joining us. We will catch you on the next episode. Cheers.
You've been listening to L&D in Action, a show from Get Abstract. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player to make sure you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating, leave a comment, and share the episodes you love. Help us keep delivering the conversations that turn learning into action. Until next time.